You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses across the globe.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Happy New Year, Richard.
Happy New Year, Lionel. And Happy New Year, Daniel Freeb.
Happy New Year, chaps. I thought we'd given up podcasting. I waited by my phone for a week and you didn't call. I was checking WhatsApp, you were never online. So I thought that was it. We were never going to speak to each other again.
Well, we kept things ticking along, didn't we? We released our cycling podcast Femina last week, the first one of the year, and our cycling podcast Breve, which was a chat with Phil Deeker. So we've kept things ticking along, but we thought we'd save our return for the first racing of the year, the Tour Down Under, which is now underway. Does that not make sense?
Kind of, yeah. It smacks a bit. Is it a bit complacent? Has the competition been stealing a march?
It's a long season, Daniel, and with our racing programme this year and our three Grand Tours, we don't want to use up too many matches too early. I think we'll save our matches.
Think we'll have a good season? Think we're going to have a good season? Confident?
Not for us to say, is it? I think it'll be enjoyable. There's lots of interesting things to look forward to, and we're going to be doing some of that in this podcast.
We're due a bad one, aren't we? We've had a couple of above average years.
ever the optimist, Daniel.
Just before we start our bad 2018, we should say a huge thank you to Rafa and Science and Sport, our sponsors from last year, who are signed up again for 2018. And we're extremely grateful to them and they and the friends of the Cycling Podcast. And thanks very much to everybody who've signed up so far at thecyclingpodcast.com. You make it easy for us to make plans for the year and we're doing that now. And we're very grateful to Rafa and Science and Sport. Doing some new things with them this year as well, so stay tuned for that. But before we crack on with this first regular podcast of 2018, Lionel, the news roundup, please.
Thank you, Richard. Yeah, it's a bumper one today because quite a lot's been going on. And as you say, the racing is underway. First of all, this is really for my benefit. I'm going to run through some of the key team changes so that I'm not calling EF Education First Cannondale. You know, I want to kick that habit as early as possible. There's quite a few changes in the peloton, the World Tour peloton. Orica Scott are now Mitchelton Scott. I'll still be calling them Green Edge, no doubt. Cannondale Drapac are now EF Education First Drapac, presented by Cannondale. Bit of a mouthful, that one, for podcasting purposes, so we'll probably shorten that to Team EF or Team EF Education First. A few colour changes as well that caught my eye already. Sky are riding in white. Their Tour de France kit has been basically adopted as their regular kit for this season, and as almost as if they're trolling them, Movistar have switched to sky blue. An interesting move, maybe to make Mikel Landa feel at home, I don't know. Lotto Soudal's kit has got a definite homage to Eddie Merckx's old Famer team. It's a kind of a red section at the top that goes down into a point and white below. It looks almost identical to the old Famer jersey of the late 1960s and early 70s.
Also very like a pack of Marlboros, isn't it?
It does look like a very, yeah, for our huge number of smokers out there who are listening to the podcast, they look like a packet of cigarettes. But my favourite is the new AG2R jersey, which looks like a sort of, I don't know, an undiscovered country's national champions jersey. It's brown, white and blue. I don't know what they're trying to say or do with that, but I think that looks quite fetching. But yeah, it's all new. It's all quite exciting, isn't it, seeing the new jerseys when they first hit the roads. The big news a week or so ago was that the Tour de France wildcard selections had been announced by ASO, and they have gone to Direct Energy. No surprise there, seeing as Lilian Calmejean won a stage last year. Cofidis, the ever-present, Fortuneo, and Wanty Group Gobert, who have the very promising young French rider Guillaume Martin. So that is almost certainly the reason for their selection, but no room for the new Vital Concept team and their sprinter Brian Cockard, who, remember, was left out of Direct Energy's team last year. So more disappointment for Cockard and co. The 2019 Tour de France, looking ahead to next year already, will start in Brussels, and there's a stage that goes over the Mur in Gennaarsbergen, the famous cobbled climb up to the Citadel that used to feature prominently in the Tour of Flanders. The Tour de France will go over there. It will also go through the town where Eddy Merckx grew up, St. Peter's Voluwe, which is also where he took the first yellow jersey of his Tour de France dynasty. That was in 1969, so this is all to mark 50 years of Eddy Merckx's first Tour de France win. A stage two of next year's tour will be a 28-kilometre team time trial around Brussels, and we'll of course find out the rest of the tour route for next year later in the autumn. One route we do know is that the Vuelta a España for 2018, the course for that has been announced. It starts in Malaga, of course, and we'll talk a little bit about that later on in this episode. There's been no resolution yet to the Chris Froome salbutamol case, but there's been some speculation in the press this week that his defence may hinge on matters relating to his kidney function. This story will probably run and run, but we'll cover that a little bit later on in this show as well. And as Richard mentioned, the racing is back, and Peter Sagan picked up where he left off last year. He won his final race of 2017, winning the World Championships, and he won his first race of this year, the People's Choice Classic, which was a couple of days before the Tour Down Under. It was a tough start for Sky's former under-23 world champion Christopher Halvorsen, because he crashed in the finishing sprint and fractured his hand. And another neo-pro who's had trouble this week is Lotto Soudal's Bjorg Lambrecht, who was not registered in the anti-doping whereabouts programme soon enough to take part in the race, so he's basically had to sit it out, and he'll make his debut at the Cadel Evans Great Ocean Road Race later this month. The racing's underway. Andre Greipel won the first stage, Caleb Ewan won the second. So far so normal for the Tour Down Under. It will no doubt be decided on the Willunga Hill stage at the end of stage five, that is. A bit of trouble with the weather. It's been very hot, so they've shortened one stage and may well shorten others as the week goes on. Meanwhile, Amanda Spratt won the Santos Women's Tour for the second year in a row. So we truly are off and running. And before I wrap up the news roundup, we're going on our own Grand Tour of Britain in a few weeks' time, aren't we? There's going to be more details of this later in the episode, but we're doing 7 live events to support the launch of our first book. If you want details, take a look at thecyclingpodcast.com now, and you can buy tickets for those 7 events.
Yeah, we will give a few more details of that later on. You say so far so normal at Tour Down Under, Lionel. You speak as a man who's never been to the Tour Down Under or to Stirling, which is a regular finish, and it's a pretty lumpy circuit and a hard climb up to the finish. And Caleb Ewan to win there as he did on stage two, quite a surprise, I think. I mean, if you look at the guys behind him, not really pure sprinters. Jay McCarthy, I mean, his teammate Darren Impey second, Jay McCarthy third, Peter Sagan fourth, Nathan Haas fifth, Elia Viviani was sixth, the first sort of regular sprinter. A very, very good result by Caleb Ewan that, and a little bit of a surprise, I would say.
Fair enough.
Every year we say next year, Lionel, you're going to the Tour Down Under. Is it going to happen next year?
Well, I think if we plan it early enough.
Well, this is early enough, isn't it? Now, plan it now.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah.
What about the Hammer Series? You were supposed to go to the Hammer Series. You didn't go to that either.
No, I didn't. That was disappointing. But unfortunately, that fell awkwardly right after my Giro stint, or right after the Giro, wasn't it? It was a week after the Giro. So, disappointing. I've
You can't be everywhere, can you? There's only one Lionel Burney, unfortunately.
And if I had to go to...
insert joke here.
If I had to go to all the races I slag off, I'd never be at home. only joking, just kidding.
On Ewan though, Rich, not really surprised that he's excelling there in Tour Down Under like he did last year. I mean, the Australian riders always tend to go well there, not least because, well, they're on home roads and they've spent a lot of time in the warm weather and been training maybe a bit more and a bit harder than some of the European riders at this time of year. Although I think Caleb Ewan has been spending some time in Ireland as well. I think his girlfriend she might be the daughter of the owner of the Aqua Blue team. I hope I've not got that wrong. There's some connection there, and he spends quite a bit of time in Ireland. But it's going to be interesting this year just to see how the sort of sprint battle and the lie of the land kind of evolves in sprinting. You've got this bit of a sort of generation gap between you and Gaviria, and then the older guys, Cavendish, Kittel and Greipel, who he won the first stage in Tour d'Andorre, didn't he? There's not too much in the middle that's going to threaten them between those two sort of categories, the very young guys and the older guys. And I sense that the sort of Kittels and Cavendishes, perhaps not so much Greipel, although I don't want to do him a disservice. I sense that they've got a year or two left ruling the roost in the Grand Tours, but the Ewans and Gaviria's are certainly sort of yapping at their heels, aren't they?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, Gaviria is another one who might have been in contention on a finish like that, but certainly it wouldn't suit all the sprinters. And it is a sign that Caleb Ewan, who's going to ride the Tour de France, of course, this year, is in excellent form. I mean, we are speaking after only two stages of the Tour Down Under, so we don't want to say too much because we will be overtaken by events and we'll talk about it properly next week. As you say though, Lionel, Willunga Hill is when it's likely to be decided. And I think it's interesting this year because Richie Porte, such a good winner there before and last year, of course, you know, he's coming back from that dreadful crash at the Tour de France, and it will be interesting to see what his fitness is like. He was he rode the National Time Trial Championship recently and was quite comprehensively beaten by Rowan Dennis, his teammate. But I'm interested to see how Richie Porte goes on Willunga, and I think that will be a very good test for him after, you know, after the injuries he suffered at the Tour last year.
Although, Rich, isn't he nominally, I think he said that he's going to ride for teammates in the Tour Down Under.
Well, that would be Rohan Dennis, presumably.
Yeah, I don't think he's going for the general classification, but we'll see.
Might just be bluffing, though.
It's very early to be bluffing, isn't it? Mid-January. I mean, it's a long old bluff if you're going to bluff. He's going to bluff his way all the way to the Tour de France. No, you're right. It will be interesting.
No, I'm talking about bluffing for Willunga Hill.
Oh, I see, yeah. Oh, that's a fair point. Yeah.
I always feel slightly guilty about this, but I probably say it every year, and certainly I think I said it last year, that every time anyone says Willunga Hill, I feel the need to put mate at the end. Willunga Hill, mate.
Well, you've been hanging out with Matt White too much in the off-season.
I should say, just a little addendum to what I should say, Luke Durbridge also was second in the time trial, the national time trial. So Richie Porte was third. It wasn't just Rowan Dennis and Richie Porte in that race.
Because the Tour Down Under is still ongoing, we'll talk about it, we'll sum it all up in next week's episode, but I've felt a bit guilty all winter, really. I've been picked up numerous times for calling the Tour Down Under a pre-season friendly in the past, so I thought I'd change the record, and I had a quick chat on the phone with Stuart O'Grady, a native of Adelaide, of course, and the winner of the first edition of the Tour Down Under in 1999, which makes this year's race the 20th edition. It's quite amazing, really. I was looking back at the early season race calendar from that season, 1999, and it stood out, you know, so starkly. It was the only race outside of Europe of any real note between, well, I mean, in almost all of the first half of the year, really. And certainly the character of the early season had changed completely from those days. You know, all of the riders would start their seasons either on the south of France coast, the Tour of the Med and the Grand Prix Marseillaise and races like that, or they'd start in Spain with the Ruta del Sol, or there were races in Italy that no longer exist. There's no longer the Giro della Reggio Calabria or the Giro di Calabria. They've both disappeared, for example. So the Tour Down Under coming along in 1999 really sort of changed the whole feel of the opening part of the season. And so I caught up with Stuart O'Grady and he's on the way to a cricket match. We didn't mention the Ashes, well, we did actually, but he was basically gloating about Australia's comprehensive win in the Ashes over England, but he was on his way to watch a Big Bash match, which sounds just as Aussie, doesn't it?
For American listeners in particular, this is cricket we're talking about, which is a bit like baseball. Anyway, Lionel, carry on.
Yeah, sorry, I was a bit lost there as well.
Oh yeah, you don't tend to have the weather for cricket up in Scotland, do you, really? Summer's only 4 days long, not even enough for a test match.
Oh, not content with alienating Australia, you can alienate our Scottish listeners as well. And on the eve of two shows in Scotland.
Oh,
fantastic.
I meant nothing against our Scottish listeners.
Lionel, if you go out of Glasgow alive, I will be amazed.
I meant nothing against our Scottish listeners. I was just having a go at you, Richard. So yeah, I spoke briefly to Stuart O'Grady and I asked him I started off by asking him how European professionals, because he was riding for a French team at the time, how they greeted the idea of travelling halfway around the world to ride a race that had no history and no background.
It was a massive task for me to convince Roger Leger. You know, Roger Leger was head of Peugeot back in the day, or Phil Anderson, Greg LeMond and all those guys. So, you know, from 95, 96, 97, 98, all the training camps are in Po in the south of France in, you know, freezing conditions, snow and rain, and because that's what had been done since the beginning of time. So I guess, in a way, luckily for me, I had some results on the track and the Olympics and stuff, and kind of also a few results on the road. Obviously, 98, you know, getting the yellow jersey and the stage and the tour and all that stuff, I started to have a little bit of, I'm not going to say power in the team, but, you know, I had the kind of balls to say to Roger, you know, is it, would it be possible to bring the team down to the Tour Down Under for this race? And there was no reason for them to come down. And as I kept saying to Roger, just come down and see one for yourself, and then you'll understand, because obviously I was rocking up into Europe with pretty good form because I was doing great training, and it was a massive coup to get them down to Australia for that first event. And once they got here, they understood what all the fuss was about.
What was that first race like for you personally, racing on roads that you would have known very well, and also in terms of how the South Australian public took to it?
Oh, look, for me personally, you know, I obviously attacked it 100% of the roads I grew up on, the city I was born in. So, you know, I was pretty pumped. But at the same time, even back then, you know, Telecom, Zabel, Stefan Vestman, all those guys were coming down to Adelaide, or they're in South Africa. You know, they were chasing the sun and training hardcore. So I knew that it wouldn't be easy. You know, there'd always be a few guys to be competitive against, but it certainly wasn't anything like the nature it is now, where guys are coming down fully prepared, teams are coming down prepared. It was a lot more relaxed. Guys were using it as their training camp, so there was no real pressure. The stages were quite a bit easier. You know, it was a bit like those early days in the Giro, a break would go up the road, give it 15 minutes and you'd slowly wind them back in, whereas now it's full gas and the racing's a lot harder and there's a lot more at stake. When it went World Tour, it just completely changed, you know, in the blink of an eye. Back in the early years, there was maybe three, four, maybe five teams that were really going well, but then as soon as it went World Tour, obviously every team was going well, so it just went from, you know, like a good preparation race to, you know, all of a sudden there's World Tour points up for grabs and people take them very seriously. You know, we had the same amount of points for a Tour Down Under as there was for, you know, a historical race like Paris-Nice. So that obviously set you up for the first World Cup race, which was Milan-San Remo, so there was a lot at stake.
Thinking about the 99 race, what's your strongest memory of that week?
Oh, I think just coming out to the first race and just, you know, not knowing if 50 people were going to come or 5,000, and, you know, 50,000 people rocked up. So just kind of blew everybody away, and the state of South Australia really got behind it. And I think it was just infectious. The race was fantastic. The weather was great. You know, I was fortunate enough to win the first one, which was kind of a bit of a Hollywood moment, I guess, for the race. Yeah, it was perfect. It just skyrocketed to, you know, heck, this is, I mean, the guys were based in the Hilton Hotel, you know, a five-star hotel in the centre of the city for 2 weeks. Training was great, you know, good food, good wine, good everything. So, you know, the guys would be training hard and then jump on the tram and heading down to the beach for a swim. So it was just very different to the guys that were slugging it out in slush and snow in France. So from then on, it was fighting for spots on the team. When you used to rock up to Tour Mediterranean or those kind of races, I mean, you really struggled to get people there. You know, it was cold. They're really struggling for sponsors, etc. And I think Tour Down Under just hit the right market. I mean, we had some great results with Australian riders. The public got behind it. They're big sponsors. And what beats a nice sunny coastal shot of the peloton racing through with great weather. So it was an instant hit, really. So I think, you know, those races which were historically fantastic in Europe, they just suffered, I guess, under the colder conditions. Like at the end of the day, it's sponsorship dollars, isn't it? It's just a lycra circus. I mean, there's events on every night, street parties. I'm sitting here now and it's about 30 degrees at, you know, 7 o'clock at night. So certainly everything's just in its favour. It's a great place to ride. It's a great city to ride in. And, yeah, what more do you need if you're a professional cyclist? Obviously, this is the place to be for training and leading into the European season.
Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Yeah, I mentioned already that Rafa are sponsoring the cycling podcast. They're our main sponsor and are so again in 2018. We're very, very grateful to them for their continued and now long support. And we thought we'd mention it's a good time of year to be thinking of trips, adventures for the year ahead. So we thought we'd mention Rafa Travel. They organise fantastic trips to some new places this year as well. Point-to-point randonnées, relaxing retreats, quick weekend escapes. They welcome riders of all abilities and ambitions. Choose between Europe's best roads in France, Italy and Spain, or look further afield to the United States, Japan and new for 2018, Colombia. They made a fantastic film, Rafa, last year about cycling in Colombia, of course. You get great support and local knowledge from the team on the Rafa Travel trips, and you get looked after by a mechanic, you get your laundry done, you get massage, you get fantastic food and wine, which is obviously very important. All you have to do is get on your bike, ride the route and pedal. It sounds very simple. Check out rafa.cc/travel for details of all the Rafa Travel trips, and it, as I say, it's a good time to be booking something for this year. Now, Lionel mentioned in his news roundup the issue of wildcards, and Daniel, you made a point about that when we took a little pause there about the absurdity really of selecting wildcard teams for the Tour de France when some of those teams have not even turned a pedal in anger.
Yeah, it just strikes me as a sort of impossible riddle to solve. Over the years we've seen the dates, the point at which the Grand Tour organisers announced their wildcards change slightly. I remember, well, back sort of around about the turn of the millennium, so, 2001, 2002, there was a lot of controversy about the wildcards. I spent a day with the Big Mat team in the Dauphiné in 2002, and they'd only just received news that they were not going to get a wildcard for the Tour de France, and obviously that imperiled their situation at the time. Since then, the Grand Tour organisers have tried to provide a bit more clarity by announcing the wildcards earlier, very early now for the Tour de France, so in January, and obviously that's before some teams, the teams that have just been launched, have even competed at all. So Vital Concept were launched amid a lot of fanfare a couple of weeks ago, and they've signed Brian Cockard. And, you imagine the kind of pitch that they made to their sponsor, Vital Concept. It's a team that's being run by Jérôme Pinot, former rider, quite a distinguished French rider. And yeah, you know, he probably went to the sponsor and talked about his confidence that they were going to be selected for the Tour de France. And we know how vital, how absolutely essential it is for French teams to be in the Tour. And, they signed Brian Cockard and they've had this sort of slap in the face. And you could say that's logical because they haven't proved themselves yet. But on the other hand, they haven't had a chance to prove themselves. And I just don't know what the best solution is here for Grand Tour organisers. Where, should they maybe announce it even earlier in the previous autumn? But then, that's before the teams have even completed their recruitment. Or if it's later, and I think this was the problem for a number of years, that they shied away from, for example, giving performance criteria and saying, right, it's going to be the best teams at the end of April, because they thought that incentivised doping. And, the Giro have tried to provide one solution by automatically allowing the winner of the season-long Coppa Italia to get a wildcard for the following year. So this year, that's Di Qui Giovanni. They still call that? No, Androni, sorry. Gianni Savia's team. So that's going to be them this year. But again, are you incentivizing doping or maybe even the wrong kind of racing by saying that, that's the prize for winning this competition? I mean, last year we heard from the owner of the Nippo Fantini team, who said the Coppa Italia was a flawed concept. This idea of incentivizing the winner of that was a flawed concept, because what you had was teams who would finish with three riders in the top 10 of Coppa Italia races and not even try to win these races, because they knew that, if they amassed points in that competition, they would get into the Giro the following year. So I don't know what your thoughts are, but I just don't really have any intelligent solution to propose.
I love the idea that you're incentivizing doping by setting performance criteria, just riding well, winning.
Well, that is definitely true, Rich.
You got to have some criteria, don't you?
Yeah, but unfortunately, that is definitely something that's been cited in the past, and I think that's the main reason why it does come so early in the season. I mean, the other issue is that if you say, okay, at the end of the Dauphiné or the end of April, we're going to choose them, then you know you might have continental division teams or pro continental division teams who focus their season on those races in April and May and are completely worn out by the time they get the wild card and no longer able to compete.
It's impossible, isn't it? I mean, you could have Paris-Nice as a selection race. But then what would you be looking for? You know, how would you measure, say, top five finishes on sprint stages with, say, a top 10 on GC?
The other thing about having a selection race in March is, you know, it's easy to say that from an armchair, just watching on TV or from somebody drawing up a set of criteria on paper. But the athletes themselves, you know, it is quite hard for the top riders to have those two peaks in form, March and then July. So for riders who are riding for teams that are scrabbling around for a wildcard place, it's kind of unfair to put that sort of pressure on people in March, and then, you know, your reward is you've got to now have the actual peak of your season for July. You want to give the teams as much notice as possible. And although on this occasion Vittel Concept have missed out and be very disappointed, they are a brand new team. And I think even signing Brian Cocker, I mean, it's not like they've signed someone with 10 Tour de France stage wins and have been left out. There's only so many places, and you can make a strong case, either commercial or sporting, for the other four teams being in the race. And really, if you had to sort of objectively rank those teams in order, you would put Vittel Concept just outside, I would say, by any sort of rational measure. It's tough luck this time, but they've got a whole season now to try and make an impression in races and get themselves on the final selection for next year.
Very reasonable, Lionel.
Well, the other issue and the sort of dark side to the murky side to all of this is there is a strong suspicion that has been for several years that teams are effectively buying their way into wildcard positions. For example, Cofidis, by being a very prominent sponsor of ASO races, and you know, particularly at the Vuelta, they're very, very prominent, and they always receive a wildcard for the Tour de France. Gazprom in the Giro d'Italia last year, I mean, figures were even bandied around how much they paid directly to RCS. These allegations were, of course, denied. And then we think we're going to hear who the wildcard entrants are for the Giro d'Italia today, and everyone is expecting the Israel Cycling Academy to get a wild card. Whether there's some kind of financial incentive for RCS, I don't know, but you know, there's certainly a connection with the race starting in Israel. So you know, there's no two ways about it. The criteria are not always strictly sporting criteria either.
Certainly true. Now, Daniel, you recently went to the launch of Team Sunweb for 2018, didn't you? It's one that you like to attend every year because it happens on your doorstep.
It does. It was a couple of kilometres from where I live in Berlin. So, a very German affair, Rich. It's a bit of a riddle, the sort of the origin or the kind of identity of this team, I suppose. It's got a German, it's registered as a German team. The presentation is always carried out strictly in German and English. But Sunweb, the sponsor, is, well, mainly a Dutch company, albeit with interest in Germany. And they've got a lot of Dutch riders, Dutch manager, a lot of Dutch staff.
Daniel, did it not become a German team when Alpecin came on board as a sponsor?
It did.
And now they remain a German team. And they remain a German team.
Correct.
Strange.
Yep. And the presentation, the pitch for the presentation to the media was that this was where we were going to find out which Grand Tour Tom Dumoulin was going to target in 2018. Fortunately, De Telegraaf, a Dutch newspaper, sort of blew the lid on that a few weeks earlier by announcing that he was going to do the Giro. So they didn't make too much of a song and dance about that in the presentation. But sure enough, he's going to ride the Giro, or he's going to target the Giro, try to defend his title. And I asked him why.
The course suits me better, and I have more chance of winning it, I think, than in the Tour de France. But it's definitely also an option to do the Tour. But we just want to keep that option open, because let's say I come out of the Giro with a really bad feeling or whatever, and then we told everyone, okay, we're going to do the double or whatever. I just want to focus on the Giro. I want to have full focus and all my energy going into the Giro, and then after the Giro we will see. Maybe we do the Tour, maybe we do the Vuelta, maybe we go to the Tour for only stages, I don't know. We already made a decision beginning of November, without knowing what Froome or any other contender would do, and I don't care what other contenders do. It's my team against other teams, and we just have to win it, whether it's Froome or whether it's Nibali or whoever. That's not in my control, so why would I watch it? Because then it would be a race who can announce the latest, what they would do, and then they would choose, and then you're making it very difficult. And but I want to be able to beat everyone. I would like to challenge everyone, so I'm not choosing for any Grand Tour with competitors in my mind.
What specifically was it about the Giro course that you really liked? I mean, the mountaintop finishes are less severe maybe than other Giros. Was that something that leapt out?
I like the fact that it has still more time trial kilometers than the Tour. And I like the fact that there are not so many high altitude mountain stages, like proper mountain stages, like the Stelvio stage we had last year. It has a lot of mountaintop finishes, but not a lot of extremely hard, high altitude stages like that. So that's something I prefer.
So Tom Dumoulin there telling you, Daniel, why he was riding the Giro again this year. And I think a lot of us remain quite perplexed about exactly why, for all that he seems to have thought it through pretty well. And he sort of contradicts himself a little bit, saying that he made the decision even before the routes were announced, and yet also said that the Giro route suits him better. How do we square that circle?
Yeah, it does sound a bit contradictory, Rich. But yeah, I think sometimes perhaps we read too much into what the route is like in a particular Grand Tour. And I think the riders themselves have a real sort of strong sense deep down about which Grand Tours they like to do, which countries they like to race in. And, you know, we've seen that with, for example, I think Thibaut Pinot at FDJ is facing a bit of a dilemma this year because he feels this real strong pull towards the Giro, and yet for his sponsor, for his team, and maybe also from the point of view of the route, it doesn't really make sense. It makes more sense to do the Tour de France. And I think with Dumoulin, it's a really sort of instinctive, impulsive thing that he feels a real draw towards the Giro and a real draw to the idea of defending his title. And you know, alongside that, on paper I do think the route suits him, particularly in the sense that you've got these summit finishes that aren't particularly daunting, four or five of them which will really suit him, and you've got more time trialing than you do in the Tour de France. So on that front it makes sense. Where it doesn't make sense from my point of view is that with the team having such a strong Dutch connection, and we all know how attached the Dutch are to the Tour de France and the idea of a Dutchman winning the Tour de France for the first time since 1980. I'm slightly shocked that Sunweb have got two strong candidates for real success at the Tour de France, Wilco Kelderman and Tom Dumoulin, and neither of them have said that they're going to target the Tour de France.
Well, Sunweb under a lot of pressure, I guess, to follow up on their extraordinary season last year. It wasn't just Dumoulin, was it? It was Michael Matthews, Warren Barguil, of course, at the Tour de France, and the team time trial. Daniel, I think you spoke to another of their outstanding riders last year, Wilco Kelderman, who rode a very good Vuelta, and Mark Reef, the coach at Sunweb, or one of the coaches at Sunweb.
I did, Rich, and we'll hear from them in a second. Just one thing that occurred to me again, and it occurs to me every year. Every year I sit in the front row at the Sunweb presentation, I look at the riders on stage, and I think these sixth formers are really going to struggle this year because they're too young. And there's not enough experience in this team, and I'm always proven wrong. So,
and there aren't many of them, are there? I mean, what, they're 23 this
23.
Year.
23, extraordinary. But they are, you know, they were the team of the year last year. They've lost Warren Barguil. They've still got Michael Matthews and Kelderman and Dumoulin. So, you know, those three in particular are going to be under a lot of pressure, I would suggest. Anyway, as you say, I did speak to Mark Reef, who's one of the coaches at Sunweb, about this issue of pressure and living up to the standards that they set last year. And straight after that, we're going to hear from Kelderman himself, talking about why, firstly, he has decided not to target the Tour de France, and secondly, why he has extended his contract. So he's extended it a year early. It was due to expire at the end of 2018, but he's now signed until 2020.
Yeah, it is living outside the team a lot. You hear it a lot that it will be difficult to do something better than last year. But I also, it was already a conversation that I had a while ago, I think, with Ivan, but also with some other guys and in the team. And yeah, since 2007 that the team started with Ivan as a manager, and that they grew every year. And that there's a kind of a development, but also the word process was already a few times mentioned at the podium. But that's also where we are in it. It was a process to come to a certain level, and to have to create a certain base where we can always fall back on. And I think that you've seen with the crash from last year, from 2016 in the beginning, that there, of course, we had a setback. But as soon as everybody was healthy at that moment, results were also starting to come, and we continued our development. And that is also something what continued this year. And that's also why I'm not afraid that we will fall back, or that it's going to be more difficult. We know what we are doing. We also get better in planning. The riders are getting older. They are getting more experienced. So what I believe and what we believe is, if we continue on this way, that we get also a very good season again in 2018. So we are not busy with, we have to do it better. No, we know what we are doing. We have our goals again, and we will go full for it.
And the decision to target the Giro, a lot of people are surprised. And Tom says the course suits him really well. What is it particularly about the course that you think, and the team thinks, and he thinks really suits him?
I think that if you start with a few years ago, that when you ask a rider what will be your target, they immediately said, without even any information, Tour de France. And that is then the starting point, and then they will look, okay, how are we going to that race? How are we going to be at the best possible level in that race? And are we looking to the programs of the riders? Okay, what are the specific qualities? What races suit them better, and in that way we are going to plan with them. And in that sentence, we also analyzed the Giro, we analyzed the climbs, we analyzed the time trials, and in the total package, the Giro suits them better than the Tour at this moment.
And I was also quite surprised to hear Wilco not say that he's targeting the Tour de France. I mean, he sort of left it open, but what is the thinking behind that?
We also look long-term development, and with him in the future, of course, it will be a target to go for the Giro or the Tour. But we think at this moment in his career that is not the right step. We are focusing with him more on the shorter stage races like Catalunya, like Romandie or Switzerland, like those kind of races. And of course, a Grand Tour, that is where everybody is looking to. But we think, and he's also thinking like that, that also those short stage races are even that important in his development. He will be the leader there. He will fight for the victory, and that will help him again in the next season, where we will target maybe some other Grand Tours or the next step to the Grand Tours.
I will do the Tour in the Vuelta. The Vuelta is GC leader, and the Tour more like a free roll, go for stage wins, help Michael maybe in the flat stages, so more the build up to the Vuelta.
Wilco, this team's had a lot of success by being quite patient with guys like Tom and other Grand Tour leaders. Did you want to do the Tour more as a leader this year, or do you think it's the right decision to be patient?
No, I think it's right to be patient. I feel not really ready to do the Tour as GC leader, but I want to do the Vuelta again as GC leader, to grow also, and to see what is happening. I think it's a really good plan. I've also really, really good program in the first part of the year. I do the same as Tom, Abu Dhabi, Tirreno, and then Catalunya, the Amstel and Flesh Wallon, and then Romandy, Swiss. So there are a lot of races where I can go my own chance and some for help for Tom. So, yeah, it's a nice program.
A year ago, the media had almost sort of forgotten a bit about you and your, you know, your reputation as a big talent in dirt cycling. And this year you come in with a bit of a different feeling, I guess, and you're suddenly a bit under pressure, a bit like the team is to repeat the successes of last year. I mean, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I feel really good about it. I grow in this team, and when I came to this team, I feel directly home. And yeah, the structure and the plans are really good in this team, and it gave me more confidence than the other. But the plans are really good, and feel really good, and I grow more. And last year I had also a lot of bad luck with the crashes, so I hope when I have a good season with no bad luck that I can grow also a little bit. So yeah, really looking forward to what is coming next year. Yeah.
And you've signed for another 2 years with the team. Were you not tempted to have another great year and then sign for 10 million euros with another team next year?
That sounds good, but no. I feel really good in this team, and I grow also as a rider, and yeah, I feel good, and yeah, I like to stay longer. It was clear for me and also for the team, and so it happened really fast.
So that was Wilco Kelderman, and before him, Mark Reef from Sunweb. And Daniel, you also asked Tom Dumoulin about the ongoing Chris Froome case, which we're going to discuss in the next part again.
And Israel.
And the Giro start in Israel, yeah. You're really interesting answers from Dumoulin, which we'll hear in a moment. The question, of course, is whether or not Dumoulin will face Chris Froome in the Giro, and that will depend on how, or indeed if, Froome's salbutamol case is resolved before then. So let's hear now from Tom Dumoulin when you put these questions to him.
I would like to give an opinion, but I also don't know all the details. And that is what hit me back with the Wiggins case when I spoke out. And then later they found different details or whatever. And then all the journalists came again back to me, and I don't want to do that again. In the past, I'm always surprised that after an A sample or even a B sample, that you immediately get suspended. That's good for the credibility, but that's not how the law system works. So our team, MPCC, the MPCC team choose to do that, and that's what I also signed for. But that's not how a normal law system works. If you commit a crime and it's not 100% sure in law, a verdict that you are guilty or not guilty, you're not in jail, only with a murder or whatever. So with that, I can understand, and maybe it's even better because now they can take the time to really look into it. Because let's say they suspend him now, and then that would not maybe not be very much better.
Tom, given, not speaking specifically about Froome, but based on what you've seen the last two or three years and the way anti-doping's gone and the way cycling's gone, do you generally trust your rivals and trust that you're riding in clean races most of the time?
Well, I did that.
You did trust.
I'm not saying anything. I really don't want to be the spokesman about this. So I really don't want to be. So, yeah.
Tom, another question you're going to love answering, just about the Giro. The start in Israel, do you have any concerns either about security or politics from a personal point of view? Or are you just going to have complete faith that the right decisions are going to be made?
I'm going to have faith in the authorities. That's the same thing. Actually, everybody is asking me about... I'm just a simple cyclist. I'm enjoying my sport. And people are asking me now, what do you think of Israel? What? How do I know? Yeah, I only know what I read in the news and what I hear on the news. And I think I know the situation, but I don't. Of course, nobody does. Only a real historian or the people from there, they really know what's going on and where their anger comes from. Or I cannot know that. And suddenly I need to give an opinion about that. That is really weird. So I'm not going to do that. I'm leaving it up to the authorities. Of course, it makes me a little bit scared if I don't want to feel unsafe. But if everybody says it's safe, I believe them. And I go and I'm going to enjoy myself. So, but I hope the organization has a plan B for the case that the authorities say that is not safe. I think it's not even, it should not even be up to an organization to make the decision whether we ride or not. It should be up to a higher thing. For me, it's about sport is about it makes me happy, and for me it's about also the entertainment. I watch football because I like to watch football, not because it has anything to do with politics. And now getting into a political discussion, and that's also strange. Why would it be? Sports should just be about fun and something simple in life, just to enjoy it. That's the only thing about sports, only enjoyment. And but yeah,
I mean, I guess people's concern is that, for example, it's been reported that Froome's been given money to start, and that he might have been given money by an individual or the Israeli government who wants to promote a certain cause. I mean, in your case, can you rule out categorically that you have had contact with anyone in Israel that might want to use you for that reason?
Yeah, I can confirm that I don't know anything about that. Maybe the team, you should ask them. But personally, I don't know anything about getting money, or I would love to get some more money on my bank account, but it's not happening, or at least not that I know of.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Yes, thank you very much to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast again in 2018. Good news for listeners to the podcast. The discount code has been revamped, and the discount is up to 25% this year. You can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com if you enter the code SISCP25 at the checkout. SISCP25. You get an extraordinary 25% off all your sports nutrition products. This year, we are going to be increasing the sort of interactive dimension to our relationship with Science and Sport and your relationship to Science and Sport as a listener to the podcast. If you have any questions about nutrition, it can be about your own nutrition or about the nutrition of the pros, any questions at all about sports nutrition, send them to us. contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. That's contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, and we'll put them to Science and Sports experts. They've got several experts from James Morton, Rob Child, and other people who work with them as well, and we'll convene these people and put these questions to them and play them throughout the year. So please send us any of your sports nutrition questions to contact@thecyclingpodcast.com.
I should add, Rich, that we welcome questions about anything. You know, cycling.
Yeah, that's true.
Cycling, our private lives, you know, politics, anything.
Well, yeah, indeed. We do get quite a lot of emails with questions. You know, we get tweets and so on as well. But some of the emails we get are obviously longer and very, very interesting in a lot of cases. And we heard Tom Dumoulin there mention, you were asking him about the Israel start for the Giro, and also the Chris Froome case, a very sort of interesting answer / non-answer to that question. I mean, you thought his response was interesting, didn't you, Daniel?
Yeah, I did. And what's also interesting was that on the day of the presentation itself, Dumoulin was presented with an award from the Association of International Cycling Journalists for being the most media-friendly rider of 2017. And he's sort of feeling the ill effects of that, in the sense that he's a bit of a, well, he's a go-to man, if you want interesting quotes, interesting interviews, yet he's realized that that doesn't always play out to his advantage. And he's made, well, as he said there, he made some comments about Bradley Wiggins and the Triumph Sinaloan case, and he's sensing, and he knows, and he's realized that people are want to know his opinion about Chris Froome, and he realizes that it's going to cost him some, perhaps some energy and some negative energy to respond, and then to have to respond to the fallout from whatever his comments are. So, you know, that's going to be something that he's going to have to deal with this year, and it's one of the sort of collateral effects of success, I suppose, for a rider. I found his reaction very interesting when I asked him whether he trusted the riders that he was racing against, generally speaking, you know, based on what's happened in cycling in the last couple of years. And, you know, we've speculated a bit about this over the last few months, what kind of state is cycling in at the moment vis-a-vis doping? You know, what is the sort of prevailing, what are the prevailing winds in cycling? Are we sort of lurching back towards a slightly darker era where doping has become more prevalent again? Or, you know, does it continue to move in a sort of positive direction? And, you know, I got the sense there from Dumoulin, although he didn't want to say anything, that, you know, he has some concerns, and that the whole, maybe the Froome thing, or maybe, you know, events of the last year or so have introduced a bit of doubt in his mind. I mean, this is presuming, of course, that he's clean, which we, you know, we don't have any reason to think he's not.
I mean, Dumoulin is, he's a very smart, thoughtful guy, and you can understand him taking the view that it's just not worth the stress sometimes to share some of his opinions. We saw this at the Giro last year, you know, when he was in the pink jersey and he said what he thought of Nairo Quintana and Vincenzo Nibali and the way they were riding, and how, you know, in fast forward, when you're at a race like that, it backfired, it generated a backlash, and it cost him stress and mental energy, I suppose. And over the course of the Giro, he probably went from being very happy to speak his mind and share his opinions to being ever so slightly more guarded. And we see this cycle repeating with riders where, you know, as they're coming up through the ranks, they have no qualms at all about speaking their mind. And it's easy for riders who don't get so much attention to speak their mind, but there comes a certain point where it becomes counterproductive for the athlete, I suppose, and that will inevitably happen with Dumoulin, as it's happened with every other rider. On to Froome then, and the ongoing salbutamol case. Froome is training at the moment in South Africa. You mentioned the news roundup, Lionel, that a story in L'Équipe this week suggested that his defence is going to hinge on the argument that there might have been a kidney issue. Now, this was something that was actually mentioned right at the start by Jeroen Swart, that the kidneys perhaps could store up salbutamol and release it all in one go. I don't know the science behind that, but that is apparently, according to L'Équipe, what Froome might try to argue.
If I can chip in there, Rich, I mean, I'm no medical expert, certainly not, certainly don't have the credentials that Jeroen Swart has, but it strikes me that it's pretty obvious that the kidneys would be involved somehow, in the sense that it's a urine test. I mean, it's like saying the ground has tested positive for puddles. We're going to explore whether the rain has got anything to do with it. You know, I mean,
of course. I mean, one thing that's puzzled me about this, though, thinking about the circumstances on the day, and if Froome took some massive dose of salbutamol, when would he have done it? Now, the stage lasted about 4 hours, just over 4 hours, I think. He doesn't carry his inhaler with him anymore. He carries it with him, but he doesn't use it in the race, apparently, since he was caught, you know, he caught on camera using it in 2014 at the Dauphiné, and that generated some negative headlines, and apparently he doesn't use it in a race anymore. Now, unless, I guess, he has to. But he finished the stage. When a rider in the leader's jersey, as he was, finishes the stage, he has to go for anti-doping. So he's met on the line by an anti-doping chaperone. That chaperone then stays with him between the end of the stage and the dope test. Now, the chaperone would have been with him throughout that period. The Team Sky press officer and his soigneur would also have been with him. So if in that period he consumed some vast quantity of salbutamol, whether that be you know, loads of puffs on his inhaler or by some other illegal method, because only puffs on the inhaler are allowed, they would have spotted it. And I don't know if that, you know, if that will form part of the defence as well, whether the anti-doping chaperone can be a witness to what went on in that period. I just don't know. But it does strike me as odd that there's this period, the four-hour stage, and then the hour plus between the end of the stage and the dope test, where, you know, Froome was being watched at all times.
And it also bears pointing out, Rich, that, you know, the report yesterday from L'Équipe was, at this stage, speculation. I mean, it might have been very good reporting, and the journalist in question, Gilles Simon, has a good reputation. But there have been no direct quotes from Froome in the press at all saying exactly what his defence is going to be. And neither in the L'Équipe piece yesterday, nor the piece that people kind of ridiculed from David Walsh, where it talked about doing, you know, using the inhaler before his interview so that he wasn't coughing. That was paraphrased in that particular piece from David Walsh. So, you know, I think it's fairly likely that something to do with the kidneys might be, well, will be explored by Team Sky, but somehow, well, I don't think, and I certainly don't know that, you know, there is going to be, that is going to be the single sort of thrust to their defence. I would imagine it's more likely that they would, you know, they would be looking at a whole sort of constellation of factors.
But none of that really will change. So say they do demonstrate that it was a problem with the kidneys. As the rule is written, as the regulations stand, that's not a defence that will mitigate against a suspension. So,
no.
You know, we're still in this limbo, which obviously the riders are being asked about. And as the season unfolds, they'll be asked about more. And as Froome returns to competition, again, we don't know when that will be, but, you know, the questions will intensify. We're in a limbo until the scientists and the lawyers can present their case. And in the meantime, we're all being asked to kind of be amateur renal specialists, aren't we? You know, it's a very unsatisfactory state of affairs that we're in, and it's not going to get cleared up anytime soon. But on the, you know, this is as much a PR kind of campaign and battle, you know, and I don't think that those two sides of this are so firmly drawn. The extremes, the people who believe Chris Froome and the people who don't, are so firmly drawn that no one's going to have their minds changed one way or the other. And I suspect I'm not going to have my mind changed either. And my mind is, I have no idea what has happened. And until somebody can, you know, set out some really kind of clear evidence, and, you know, it's going to be very difficult to draw a conclusion one way or another. But one thing from the outside that does seem slightly strange is that, you know, everyone sort of goes, oh, Chris Froome, oh, he's got all these illnesses and ailments, and yet he still manages to win one of the toughest bike races in the world. And when you boil down what it's all about, that's kind of the point. The whole point of the Grand Tours, if you like, is that they break people down physically over 3 weeks. And I think it's kind of weird that we think that people wouldn't start developing medical anomalies and illnesses and ailments and showing strange results when the body is put under that much stress in those conditions for that period of time. That's kind of the whole reason, you know, the races are that set up in the way that they are, and they're the whole reason that we kind of marvel at the feats of the athletes that take part in them. They are on the brink and on the edge. And so if we're all going to throw our arms up and go, well, this is unbelievable, I just can't possibly believe that somebody who's ridden 3,500 kilometres in 3 weeks or whatever it was has started to show signs of, you know, strange physiological effects. I think, well, that's, you know, that is what the sport does. That's what it pushes people to.
Rich, you've got a theory, haven't you? A reader's got an excellent theory. A reader, sorry, a listener.
Well, it's a fascinating one. I got an email from Arthur Cook, who listens to the podcast. I hope you don't mind me reading your email, Arthur, but it really did pique my interest. He says, I hope you can humour a fan theory I've come up with. Chris Froome is getting tested by the UCI for his salbutamol levels this Friday, the 19th of January. Now, Arthur Cook bases this theory on having studied Froome's Strava account and being amazed at the volume he was putting in over the last few weeks. He thought back to the fallout from his adverse analytical finding and remembered that the UCI and WADA might want to test him under similar conditions. He believes that he's trying to replicate those conditions right now while training in South Africa. He pulled up on the stage of the 2017 Vuelta and realised that by the end of the 18th stage, he'd ridden 1,826 miles over 20 days. Arthur notices that from December the 31st until January the 16th, Froome has ridden almost the same, 1,592 miles, and he's got a few more days to make up the difference and bring it to a very similar volume, at least. So he thinks that he's trying to replicate riding a Grand Tour at the moment. And I know that, you know, Froome has started the season the last couple of years in Australia at the Herald Sun Tour. He's not doing that this year. He's intending to start his season much later. And obviously that depends on what happens with his case. But it's a very, very interesting theory that no idea at all whether there's any truth to it. But thanks for your contribution to the debate, Arthur. It's a fascinating theory. And, you know, you wonder, Froome is not always on Strava, doesn't post all his rides on Strava. And you wonder whether him returning to Strava and posting all these rides is part of some kind of effort to show that he is, you know, if he does the test and if there are some results come out of it, he'll have a record of what he did to try and prove that what happened was some kind of natural reaction.
And he's doing it in a hot place, isn't he, in South Africa. So, you know, it was very warm at the Vuelta.
But even if it does, I repeat the point, you know, I don't know one way or the other. And we you know, we don't know how this result has arisen. But in a way, it almost doesn't matter. I don't see that there's going to be quite a leap taken to go from proving that it's an anomaly that happened because of a set of circumstances and then using that to say that there shouldn't be a suspension. There's no provision, as far as I can see.
The great unknown here is how many cases have there been like this in the past? We don't know whether... We know that Froome has said that he's never had a case like this, but we don't know. We the precedents that we're going on are precedents where there has been an anti-doping rule violation at the end of it. We don't know how many adverse analytical findings there have been which have subsequently been never come to light because the athlete has been able to demonstrate that something has happened to their body and they haven't actually broken the rules. And what Froome argues here is that he didn't break the rules, that he didn't take more than the permitted number of puffs on his inhaler.
That's true, Rich. Although I think in a previous podcast we did cite the Pataki case, an Italian expert that was consulted in that, who worked at the International Olympic Committee lab in Rome, and he said he'd tested sort of 70,000 samples over a certain period of time, and he'd seen about 5 or 6 anomalies in that time in terms of salbutamol levels, which suggested that it was quite rare. But we don't know in cycling. Just one further point, Rich. Lionel, I said to Lionel that, you know, just witnessing the kind of reaction to the sort of ongoing, now protracted Froome saga, what a huge sort of handbrake this all is on the development of cycling and its popularity, because people are so upset and get so emotive, and, you know, some people really sort of throw the baby out of the bathwater, say this is it for the sport, this, you know, it's rotten, I'm not going to follow it again. And you know, until people can be a bit more sanguine about the whole thing and just, you know, let the due process play out, then cycling's popularity is going to have this kind of, it's going to be restricted, because there is no clarity. People don't like it. They don't like the lack of transparency, but this is kind of what has to happen, and you just have to accept it. And these cases are going to happen as long as we have things like TUEs and specified substances and just any anti-doping system. You know, these cases are going to come along every few years. And the problem is that the stakes are so high, in the sense that, you know, you've got one rider around whom a lot of the sport revolves. You know, he's a multiple Tour de France winner, and you've got a whole team that depends on him being there, and you've got a whole nation, the United Kingdom, which wasn't that interested in cycling. And if Chris Froome gets banned and Chris Froome's career ends, their whole interest is not going to fall away to nothing, but it's certainly going to diminish hugely. And, you know, and I think this is one of the problems with the kind of the sort of punitive model that cycling has started and sport has started to adopt in the last few years, whereby bans are longer and longer and the stakes are higher and higher. And you compare that to sort of cycling in the 60s and 50s and 60s, where sort of doping bans were, you know, 2 months or a few weeks, and people didn't get that exercised about the whole issue, and they were a lot more sanguine about the whole thing. It's just difficult to find a compromise. You know, on the one hand, you're trying to create a culture whereby no one will dope because the stakes are so high, and you might get banned for life. But then, you know, with that comes the risk of someone being convicted falsely and someone, you know, losing their career, losing their livelihood. And also, you can't have things like, if you're going to go down that road of saying, right, we're not going to tolerate anything and any kind of grey area, you can't have TUEs, you can't have things like specified substances, because it just doesn't work.
Well, you are absolutely right, Daniel, especially when you look at another event going on in Australia at the moment, the Australian Open Tennis, and the way that Maria Sharapova has been sort of welcomed back into the fold there and was part of kind of the official, you know, not opening ceremony of the tournaments, but certainly at some kind of pre-tournament event. Different sports have different attitudes towards all of this kind of stuff, and cycling, you know, cycling has been under the microscope, not just more broadly, but also from its own fans. And I think, but what you're advocating there is a kind of a turn half a blind eye to the medicalization of the sport and say, well, this really doesn't concern us. We should just stick with what goes on the road.
I mean, not necessarily turn a blind eye, but I mean, I'm just sort of pointing out that, you know, there's this perception that cycling is more popular than ever. Well, you know, in some places, that's not the case. Cycling was more popular when people didn't have this cloud hanging over their heroes, you know, where if there was a doping case, it was kind of resolved and it was sorted in a matter of weeks. You know, people like Eddie Merckx in the 60s, you know, tested positive and then the issue was kind of closed within 2 or 3 months. And you know, you think about the way other kinds of cheating are viewed in other sports, like diving in football, for example, and it's dealt with pretty quickly and then people move on. But in cycling, and this is, you know, this is a very broad question, and it's about attitudes to drugs, I think. It's not really about attitudes to cheating. It's about the way drugs were stigmatized at a certain point in history. And consequently, you know, we make a distinction between other kinds of cheating and doping. Doping is almost tantamount to murder. It's the worst. It's the most heinous of crimes. And, you know, if that's the case, if we're going to say that doping is that serious, then can we really justify spending a few million euros on anti-doping at the UCI in a year when the biggest teams in the sport have budgets of 30 million euros? I mean, if we're really going to take it that seriously, then I think the resources that need to be put into it have to be of that order. You know, it has to be tens of millions, hundreds of millions spent on anti-doping every year if we're going to decide that it's that important.
That's not going to happen, though, is it? I mean, you raise a lot of points, Daniel. It's where, and you comparisons with other sports are interesting, I suppose. It's only cycling and to some extent athletics too. These are the sports which are viewed through a doping lens, exclusively sometimes through a doping lens, and defined by that, you know, whereas cheating in other sports, there seems to be a slightly more pragmatic attitude to it. You know, I mean, in football in the UK, Manchester City are running away with the title. They have an anti-doping rule violation against their name, don't they? But certainly nobody defines that club by that, and their manager has an anti-doping rule violation to his name as well. So in cycling, that wouldn't be sort of left unsaid, but in the case of football, the club moves on, and it's something that's never really mentioned again. It's just a different set of values, different standard applied in cycling to other sports. But I'm always uncomfortable with these comparisons, because the fact that that doping is not a big issue in other sports doesn't mean that it shouldn't be a big issue in cycling. And I think the problems in cycling are quite specific, especially to the 90s, and when we saw the effects of a transformational drug like EPO and how that distorted results. And nobody who watches it or reports on it wants that, do they? And that's what's done the damage to cycling and created these extreme levels of you know, cynicism, scepticism around performances. Anyway, moving on, chaps. The Vuelta route has been announced, and thoughts on that? Are you looking forward to the holiday Grand Tour this year, Lionel?
Well, I am. It's going to bits of Spain I've not been to before. It starts down in the south, doesn't it, in Malaga. I know that area reasonably well. It's okay, isn't it? I think down there, not too bad. But it's sort of the middle bit, or the left middle bit of Spain, the countryside that it kind of goes up to as it works its way up to the northwest, completely unfamiliar to me. I know nothing about that region at all. And so rather like the Giro a couple of years ago, I'm looking forward to exploring some territories I've not been to before. But in terms of the race itself, I'm struck by something Daniel wrote in the forthcoming Cycling Podcast book about how the Vuelta seems to have the most secure sense of its own identity. And, you know, looking at just a snapshot from the race profiles, you know, it's the same kind of stage race on the menu again, isn't it? The key things are the short stages, lots of uphill finishes. It's going to appeal to the same kinds of riders that it's appealed to for the last 6, 7, 8 years. And a return to the Lagos de Covadonga, which is kind of the... it has this sort of... it's a sort of Spanish mystical climb, isn't it? It's the big one, if you like, the one that Robert Miller and Pedro Delgado duelled out on in the mid-80s, and it's returned there several times since. So I've not been there, so I'm looking forward to that particularly. So I don't know how we're going to cover the Giro and the Vuelta this year, whether we're going to be doing all of it.
Well, we are going to be doing all of it. We are going to be
whether,
doing all
yeah,
of it.
Yeah, but whether individually, whether we're going to be coming in and out, taking rest days or not. But I could certainly...
I've got you down, Lionel, for the two stages in Andorra.
I was kind of ignoring that. I mean, it's there's a contract, isn't there?
Some, the grand finale.
The grand finale, yeah. Yeah, there's ASO has obviously succumbed to
the charms
of Andorra. Maybe they're knocking out perfume and watches from a suitcase somewhere in Boulogne-Billancourt in their neck of the woods in Paris, and they need to go back to Andorra once or twice a season to stock up on supplies. I don't know. Can possibly speculate, but I wouldn't be too unhappy to miss Andorra.
Christian Prudhomme and Thierry Gouvenou in a reenactment of Only Fools and Horses in their Reliant Robin.
Yeah, they're about the right heights as well, aren't they? Gouvenou would be Del Boy, and there's a touch of the Rodneys. There's a touch of the Rodney Trotters about Christian Prudhomme.
Oh, that's very unkind to Christian Prudhomme, I think. I don't really see that myself.
We've just lost a whole load of other American listeners. It's go on YouTube, Only Fools and Horses. There'll be lots of clips.
Fantastic. Listen, we should. Have you got anything to add on the Vuelta route,
yes,
Daniel,
Rich,
before we wrap things up? Because we have gone on quite a long time here.
Yes, but that's what the people want. You know, you said we were going to have a good season, and they want us to drone on endlessly. Well, the first things that stand out is a vast improvement in terms of transfers. Just one long one from Andorra to Madrid. The medium mountain stages probably won't be as spectacular this year without Contador, because he sort of lit them up last year. Two real climbs to look out for. 14th stage, a climb called Les Prayeres de Nava in Asturias. It's the real monster of this race. It might be the most barbaric climb the Vuelta's ever done. It's about 4 or 5 kilometers long and 14% or something average. It reminds me, the only climb I've ever seen that hard was one in the south of Germany called the Gruntenhütte, which is in one of my books. That climb got the final okay from Javier Guillen in July, so he's the race organizer, after on the day when he apparently visited a local cider festival. So he might have been drunk when he decided that climb should go in the race. And then a couple of days later, there's Covadonga, then there's a time trial to Torre la Vega, home of Manolo Saiz and Oscar Freire. And then there's this mountaintop finish on the Monte Oiz. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it, because it's a Basque name. And this incredible wild plateau overlooking the Bay of Biscay that's been christened the Balcony of Biscay. It's also an incredibly difficult climb, 5 kilometers. Its gradient's constantly above 10%. So, There's the usual dose of exciting, new, interesting climbs. I think, you know, there's been some criticism already for the usual sort of ski and surf formula of the Vuelta. So, you know, a lot of finishes at the seaside or at ski resorts, and a lot of them up very, very steep climbs. But, you know, I kind of like it. As Lionel said, as I've said before, I think the Vuelta really knows what it is at the moment, contrary or to a greater extent than the Tour and the Vuelta, and I think it's good.
Yeah, we look forward to the Vuelta as we look forward to all four Grand Tours this year, because the fourth Grand Tour of Great Britain in 2018, although we hear you, we've produced a map, and it does show that the Southwest and Wales have been missed out of our Grand Tour, the Cycling Podcast Grand Tour of Britain. We do apologise for that. We just couldn't get everywhere, but we hope that we will, you know, do some more events soon.
Such a point of, you know, picking apart the Grand Tour routes and the Tour of Britain route over the years. Oh, this is good, this is not so good. It's not as easy as all that, is it?
Now we know how Mick Bennett feels. I mean, we certainly have had a big response to the lack of events in Wales and around Bristol, for example. We definitely hear that, and we're gonna try and address that soon. And but we are going to Salford, to the Keys Theatre in the Lowry, Salford, on Wednesday the 28th of February. On Thursday the 1st of March, we'll be at the Signet Library again in Edinburgh. on Friday the 2nd of March at Oran Mór in Glasgow. Two fantastic venues there that I know well. On the 7th of March, that's Wednesday the 7th of March, Nottingham Arts Theatre. On Thursday the 8th of March, the Round Chapel in Hackney in London. On Friday the 9th of March, the Carriage Works in Leeds. And on Saturday the 10th of March, the Showrooms in Sheffield. All the details at thecyclingpodcast.com. Tickets have been selling really well, and we're very grateful to everybody who's bought a ticket. You can buy a ticket and a book and get the book at a discount price. The book is A Journey Through the Cycling Year, and it will be available on the 1st of March. And in Salford, Edinburgh and Glasgow, we'll be joined. It'll be Lionel, myself, Orla Chinoui and Francois Tomazo. And for Nottingham, London, Leeds and Sheffield, it'll be Lionel, myself and Daniel. And in London, we'll also be joined by Orla as well. So a bit of a rotating cast, but we're really looking forward to it and to the book coming out.
It's my kind of grand tour, Richard. Four rest days in the middle. Looking forward to that.
Excellent. As I say, all details at thecyclingpodcast.com, and you can go from there to the venues and buy your ticket. So we look forward to seeing people on the road, and as I say, hope to add some more events soon. Is that all for this week, chaps? Any other business?
No, I think that's it's an early season ramble. It's with so much speculation. I mean, I'm discombobulated already.
How are we going to keep this up?
How did Lionel get on with his bike riding over Christmas holidays?
Oh
well, I think that's the end of the episode. Right, we'll see you all again next week. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Daniel.